when you hear a show tune from the Great White Way, does a shiver run through ya? Well, we're giving them to ya. Sing hallelujah and shout hooray. Come on along and listen to Broadway to Main Street.
My mother didn't raise her boy to be a dancer, that was not her mission. My father hoped I'd be an engineer or a financier, that's what he was wishing. So I'm afraid that they could never love me with my arms above me in the fifth position. But I'm a guy who's got a dance, don't know exactly why. Music puts me in a trance, and I must dance or die. Mornings I waltz out of bed to an Irish reel or a Highland fling instead before each meal. When somebody beats a drum, I'm not the quiet kind. My control is overcome. I start to lose my mind. Love to swap my business clothes for my dancing pants. Anyone who knows me knows I'm a guy who just gotta dance.
He's a guy who's gotta dance. That's how he gets his kicks. All night long he's gotta dance till neighbors all yell Nix.
Dancing on their ceiling, I never even yawn. Wonder how they're feeling by the time it's dawn.
Carioca, conga line, can-can or castle wall. Any rhythm suits him fine, just so his feet can talk.
Love to swap my business clothes for my dancing pants. Anyone who knows me knows I'm a guy who's just gotta dance.
Well, if anyone got a dance in the history of the American musical theater, it had to have been Jerome Robbins. Hello, this is Larry Maslon, your host for Broadway to Main Street here on 88.3 FM, Peconic Public Broadcasting, emanating today from a very on-the-town-like rehearsal room here on Broadway itself. And I am thrilled that today we are joined by it was quite simply the best biographer of Jerome Robbins there ever was, Amanda Vale, who has a new book out called Jerome Robbins by Himself, Selections from His Letters, Journals, Drawings, Photographs, and an Unfinished Memoir. I could barely get all that out. But we're going to talk today about probably the most important director-choreographer of the 20th century. So welcome, Amanda.
Well, thank you for having me, Larry. This is so much fun.
Well, your book is rather extraordinarily constructed. It's more of a collage almost than a straight history.
Thank you for saying that. That's so clever.
And I love the way that you took all these, as I said, letters and memoirs and different jottings and telegrams and, you know, your father's mustache. But you don't, you tell his story chronologically, but you tell it with memorabilia that come from all points in his life.
Absolutely. Well, you know, Robbins himself loved collage. During the 70s, he kept diaries, which are in the book. And in fact, there are reproductions of the beautiful color pages in those diaries in the book. But he would put all kinds of things into these collages. And even when he was a little boy, he made a book for his mother, a page of which is, again, reproduced in this book, which was a collage. And I just, when I was looking for a form for this book and realizing I had this incredible amount of material that this was the perfect form for it.
Indeed. It's a beautiful book, and anybody who loves the American Musical Theater must go out and get a copy. Well, we heard a little bit when we started, we heard Harold Lang from Look Ma, I'm Dancin', a show that was sort of based on Robin's own life initially. But let us jump ahead to 1943 into 44, when we're dealing with the show that, even though it isn't a Broadway show, it's probably the most important dance piece to ever initiate a Broadway show. And I'm talking, of course, about Fancy Free. And you have in your book this extraordinary, what would you call it, a précis, a synopsis?
It's a scenario.
Scenario.
He wrote out not just the movement that he envisioned would be in the ballet and what would happen if this person would do this and this person would do that, but he also put in the tempi, the kind of music. He practically put in the number of beats, you know. He didn't leave a whole lot to the imagination. As he said later, the reason he did this was to persuade the company he was dancing with, American Ballet Theatre, that they could do it, that this was a doable ballet. And the only way he knew to do that was to describe absolutely everything. But it set the tone for his relationship with his soon-to-be collaborator, Leonard Bernstein, who came on board to write the score for it.
So it says here, action. Three sailors explode onto the stage. They are out on shore leave looking for excitement, women, drink, and any kind of fun they can stir up. Let's hear how Leonard Bernstein interpreted that. Fancy Free led inevitably into On the Town, which you talked about the collaborators he has in his life, but not only brought Bernstein into the picture, but George Abbott, Betty Comden and Adolph Green, Oliver Smith, who we get to learn more about in your fantastic book. What was so, if you can reduce it to the headline news, as it were, what was so significant about On the Town in 1944 from I guess from a dance point of view, let's look at it through that lens.
It was the first show that really, really integrated the dance and the and a book musical, and actually made the dance not just an illumination of what was going on, but it made it the action. And it is a, you know, you have sung through musicals, it's a danced through musical in an awful lot of ways.
That's beautifully put. And I think emotionally, Bernstein's music is so evocative, and then the Robbins choreography just takes the story of these characters, which are much more evolved than they were in Fancy Free, into another level. I was always found it interesting when people love, quote unquote, the 1949 movie. I said, you don't really know On the Town. And one of the things I think was particularly tragic, in addition to getting rid of most of the Bernstein music and all of the Robbins choreography, is Sinatra was promised that he could sing Lonely Town, and that's the only reason he signed up, and they cut it. So let us hear Sinatra singing Lonely Town into this beautiful pas de deux from musical of the same title. I'm here with author Amanda Vail talking about the one, the only Jerome Robbins. Now, since you're such a clever person, Amanda, your title, Jerome Robbins by Himself, is a bit of a pun, isn't it? Because it's not really just about him. It's about all these extraordinary people who passed through his life, the most important creators for the ballet and the musical theater of the 20th century.
That is correct. What it is, it's meant to be sort of ironic in that sense, but also this is Robbins by Robbins.
Well, one of the most fascinating things for me, it actually sort of blew me away, is of all the people whom he connected to in a very deep, almost inexplicable way, was Irving Berlin. When you think of these two guys, in a certain way, they couldn't be more different. Robbins, who was so out there in the real world, and Berlin, who was so strange and reclusive in many ways. And I guess they may have recognized this sort of assimilationist streak in each other, the need to deal with their Jewishness in completely different ways. But the moments in the book, especially a eulogy that he gave at Berlin's memorial, just burst into tears. It was quite extraordinary. Did you expect that relationship between the two of them?
No. And because Berlin is, as you say, is this sort of ebullient, very sort of extroverted figure in many ways, at least his work as in Robbins was such a much more kind of dark and complicated person, seemingly. And yet they did intersect in this way. And Berlin spoke to something in Robbins, which he also probably could not have spoken about until much later in his life, which is his feelings of love for the people he had come from and his love for the people he had come to be among. And Berlin did that. That was what he did in spades. And Robbins suddenly recognized that in himself, and it drew forth. He cried when he gave that eulogy.
Wow.
He was in tears. You know, he was wiping his eyes at the end of it, and so was everybody in the audience. It was just heartbreaking.
Well, when they were working on Call Me Madam in 1950, which Robbins choreographed for George Abbott, he was desperate to have something to dance about, and it seems like Irving Berlin obliged him.
Something to dance about, someone to dance it with, something to dance it to a foxtrot or a waltz. Put on your dancing shoes, here comes some happy news. Break up in twos and twos to a foxtrot or a waltz. You and someone have parted, and your lonely heart yearns. While you're there brokenhearted, suddenly he returns. That's something to dance about, with someone to dance it with. Pick something to dance it to a foxtrot or a waltz. Someone to dance it with, something to dance it to a foxtrot or a waltz. Put on your dancing shoes, here comes some happy news. Break break up in twos and twos to a foxtrot or a waltz. You and someone have parted, and your lonely heart yearns. While you're there brokenhearted, suddenly he returns. That's something to dance about, with someone to dance it with. Pick something to dance it to a foxtrot or a waltz.
To a foxtrot or a waltz.
To a foxtrot or a
of course, is the March of the Siamese Children from The King and I. It's the film version. Talk to me a little bit about Robin's role when he wasn't directing and choreographing. So obviously he was just the quote-unquote just the choreographer for King and I. But in your book, you have this wonderful dramaturgical précis that he sends to Oscar Hammerstein about how the show should work its way out, because the director, the original director with John Van Druten, I guess, was hopeless. And they really needed somebody who had a kind of vision on the show.
Well, what is extraordinary, actually, about that letter is that Robbins wrote it before he'd actually got to work on the show. And he was in Paris. He was writing to Hammerstein, telling him how excited he was to work on the show. And he's talking about how he'd gone to an embassy. He'd seen these Asian dancers doing these incredible things. And he said, well, excuse me if I'm sort of stepping out of the boundaries of what my role should be, but it really feels as if you need to have a vocabulary for movement for the whole show, and it needs to have decorum, it needs to be courtly and elegant, it's never going to be cheesy, and you're never selling it. I'm paraphrasing him here. And the other thing that he says that I think is so amazing is he talks about seeing these two dancers on either side of the stage, a man and a woman, and they never touch each other, but they have this incredible sexual attraction and magnetism for each other. And Robin says, how sexy this is. And that's, of course, what the whole show is in King and I.
Right.
And he gave it to them on a plate. He hadn't really seen anything yet. He just been higher.
He just understood the difference in the two cultures
right
in the show.
It's amazing.
Two of the quote-unquote supporting characters in your book, who I love, who we always love, are Betty Comden and Adolph Green. And he seems to get Adolph's sort of wacky neurosis. And I think he refers to Betty Comden as the, maybe not the den mother, but she was the one who tended to take care of all of them.
She's the grown-up in the room. And he loved them, I think, in part because they'd all been kids together, mm-hmm. and they went way back. They had history. They knew how to work together. They understood what the other one was thinking always. I think there was not a need always to say things. You just understood them. And I know that for me, and I think for anybody who works in a collaborative relationship, that's the kind of collaborator you really like to have, or the ones you don't have to explain anything to. You can just work. And they understood, too, because they'd known him when he was young, how charming he could be, because he could be enormously charming and really funny and, he'd kid around with them the way he probably didn't do very often when the stakes were higher later on in his life.
Right. Well, in the mid-50s, he brings Betty and Adolph and Julie Stein in to help save Peter Pan. Let us hear Betty Comden herself sing one of the songs that they wrote for that particular production.
I know a place where dreams are born and time is never planned. It's not on any chart. You must find it with your heart. Never, never land. It might be miles beyond the moon, or right there where you stand. Just keep an open mind, and then suddenly you'll find. Never, never land. You'll have a treasure if you stay there, more precious far than gold. For once you have found your way there, you can never, never grow old. So come with me where dreams are born and time is never planned. Just think of lovely things and your heart will fly on wings forever. It never, never lies.
This is Larry Maslon, your host for Broadway to Main Street here on 88.3 FM. And we're here today with the wonderful, glorious, and eloquent Amanda Vail, who has a new book out called Jerome Robbins by Himself. And she's going to appear almost 2 weeks from now on January 18th at Bookhampton in East Hampton on Saturday afternoon. And I assume talk about the book, read from it?
I absolutely will. And I will be signing copies of it. And they will be selling it.
And we will be buying it.
Yes, please.
Oh, that's fantastic. We talked a little bit about Betty Comden and Adolph Green, who I gather were almost on his next project, Gypsy. And One of the things I've always been fascinated about, I know nothing about ballet. I certainly wouldn't come within a million miles of your knowledge about ballet. And yet there was something about Robbins that didn't seem to have this high-low distinction in his work. And it seemed like he tackled something like Gypsy, which was the dregs of show business in the late 20s, early 30s, or it's what it portrayed, with the same kind of enthusiasm and staging the kid numbers and that kind of stuff.
Well, you have to remember, too, and he writes about this in his diaries and in his memoirs, he came up through sort of touring showbiz, which is kind of what ballet theater was. It was a ballet company, but it was a very showbizy ballet company. And there was a lot of, you know, people crammed into dressing rooms and people misbehaving in their lodging houses and all of
and
that
doggies.
Was going on. Yeah, yeah, really. So, you know, that kind of slops over into this. Also, his family, and I don't go into this much, but there's a little bit of it in the book. His family had been some of them had been vaudevillians, and so, you know, this was a world he was familiar with, and he loved it. He loved showbiz.
Broadway, Broadway, we've missed it so. We're leaving soon and taking June to star her in a show. Bright lights, white lights, rhythm and romance.
To Hollywood via Jerome Robbins. I don't think too many people know that he had such a strong hand in the film of West Side Story, which I think you could say that without contradiction, actually made the reputation of the show. The original production was a sort of succès d'estime, but it was the movie that really entered it into the popular consciousness. And he did talk a little bit about that, because he did some filming and then he just got too meticulous and too complicated and the studio let him go.
Well, it had been he insisted on being put into this film. Because he was an author of the show, he would not release rights unless he was allowed to co-direct. And the studio did not want him to, but they understood the value of having him stage the dances. So one of the brilliant things that they did was to set up the shooting schedule in such a way that they got all of the dances out first. He did all of that dance work, and then they fired him.
Wow.
So that then they filmed all the, you know, book scenes.
Right.
And he nonetheless maintained.
I have to say, listeners, you have to have looked at the look on Amanda's face when she said book scenes. But yes, go ahead. You can just imagine it. Go ahead.
Anyway.
Not the strongest point in the show, in my opinion, so I'll take the heat for that. Go ahead.
At any rate, when the show was when the film was in the can and they were editing it, Robbins insisted, because he had been let go just at the very end, and that the scene that they were shooting when he was fired was Dance at the Gym, and he had not overseen it with his customary meticulousness, and he wanted to screen it and comment on the cut. And when he did, he wrote Robert Price a note saying, this is just not very good, and it really needs to be redone. And he explains all the things that are wrong with it, which are such a brilliant illumination of Robin's eye, of his knowledge of exactly where the camera should go, his knowledge of where the dramatic center of a scene is and what you need to be looking at in order to get that. Mm. And the best thing is the part where he says to Wise, I don't care about the choreography. What I want to maintain here is the mood and the emotion. If you lose that, you've lost everything.
He wanted the movie to capture something to dance about.
Yes.
And again, one of the great things about your book is this letter from a guy with a big ego who's just been fired from a big movie is so generous and so menschy. I think that's the big surprise for me in your book is even in these letters to Arthur Lawrence or Steve Sondheim where there is some problem, of course there are always problems with Arthur Lawrence, there were always problems. he is so not passive aggressive. He's direct. He knows what he wants and he knows what he wants to say. So, again, I can't recommend this book highly enough for people who love these great creators of the 20th century. Let us hear The Suite of Dances. It's actually taken from the show Jerome Robbins Broadway, but The Suite of Dances from West Side Story, which is very much with us late and soon these days.
Oh, yes.
Go!
and we fade out. Now, Jerome Robbins' great sort of ephemeral skill, George Kaufman also had it, George Abbott had it, I guess, was to be a play doctor. And you have a great reference in your book about him play doctoring. A funny thing happened on the way to the forum, which I think he calls a funny thing happened to me on the way to the forum in one of these things. He must have been. But let's hear Sondheim himself tell the story of Jerry Robbins' involvement in that show.
Gods of the theater, smile on us. You who sit up there stern in judgment, smile on us. You who look down on actors, and who doesn't? Bless our little company and smile on us. Think not about deep concerns. Think not about dark dilemmas.
We offer you song and dance.
We offer you rights and levels.
We offer you jokes and insults, grace and beauty. Bless our play and smile.
Forget war, forget woe. Forget matters weighty and great. Allow matters weighty to wait for a while. For this moment, this brief time, frown on reason, smile on life.
Forget pomp, forget show. Forget laurels, helmets, and crowns. Receive lovers, liars, and clowns for a while.
For this moment, this brief span, celebrate the state of man.
That was the first part of a song called Forget War, which was the original opening of Forum when Jerry Robbins was going to direct it. But Jerry decided not to, and he was replaced with George Abbott. And George Abbott didn't like the song. He couldn't hum it, he said. So out it went.
Love is in the air, quite clearly, people everywhere. Hasty, some are halting, some are simply somersaulting. Love is going around. Anyone exposed can catch it. Keep your window closed and latch it. Leave your house and lose your reason. This is the contagious season. Love is going around. La la la, la la la.
That song was called Love is in the Air, and George Abbott could hum it. And that's what we opened with in New Haven. And the show was a disaster. And we didn't know what was wrong with it. The book seemed to be funny, but the audience wasn't laughing. Nobody was having a good time. We got down in Washington. The show was still a disaster. We called in Jerry Robbins to help out. He took one look at the show and he said to me, "Steve, Love is in the Air is exactly the wrong number. It's a charming number. It misleads the audience. They don't know it's going to be a low comedy show. You've got to write a number that tells them that." I said, "I wrote a number called Forget War, which told them that." And George Abbott turned it down, I said grumpily. And Jerry said, "Then you've got to write another number that tells them what it's about that George Abbott will like." And so I wrote Comedy Tonight.
Something familiar.
Something peculiar.
Something for everyone, a comedy tonight.
Something appealing.
Something appalling.
Something.
Comedy tonight.
Nothing with kings.
Nothing with crowns.
Bring on the lovers,
liars, and clowns.
Old situations, new complications. Nothing portentous or polite. Tragedy tomorrow.
Comedy.
Comedy. Comedy.
Comedy.
Comedy.
Comedy.
Tonight.
Wow. Jerome Robbins this afternoon. I am here today with Amanda Vail with her terrific book about Robbins, her collage of Robbins' personal writings called By Himself. We get to his, for me, his greatest contribution to the musical, Fiddler on the Roof. But is it fair to say that one of the subplots in this entire book from page one to page, I don't know, what, 400 and something? Almost 400 is his relationship with being Jewish and the culture of Judaism.
Yes, it is. And it's such an important thread. There is the most beautiful reminiscence at the beginning of the book, which he wrote much later, obviously, in his life, but it tells about how he went back with his mother and sister to the shtetl in, it's now Poland, or was then Poland, where his father had come from. And he writes about it as if it's this kind of Yiddish Arcadia. It's the most beautiful, golden memory of this place. It's a paradise. And of course, it was destroyed in World War II, and the terrible pain of that was with him always. And it wasn't until after the war, until he was really in middle age, that he was reconciled enough to his feelings about Judaism, about everything. And I think the war, or the post-war period, had something to do with bringing him into a reconciled frame of mind about this. But suddenly he wanted to recapture that. And Fiddler, he wrote, and I include this in the book too, a telegram to Ruth Mitchell, who would be the stage manager for it, and said, "Ruthie, I'm going to do a musical about with Bach and Harnack. It's about our people." It's lovely.
Well, one of my favorite pieces of music ever in the American theater was actually cut from the original cast album of Fiddler on the Roof. They couldn't squeeze it in. But due to the magic of digital archiving, we're going to hear the wedding dance from the original cast of Fiddler on the Roof, choreographed by none other, of course, who else could it be? Jerome Robbins. Mazel tov. I'm here with Amanda Vale. Gee, you know, where's the time all gone to, right? We could have spent many hours talking about Jerome Robbins, but her new book, Jerome Robbins by Himself, which is a compilation of personal writings by Robbins, quite extraordinary. It's really a must for any American musical theater fan, and thankfully she'll be coming from Broadway literally to Main Street in Main Street, East Hampton on January 18th on Saturday afternoon at Bookhampton to talk about the book and sign it, of course. So I noticed something, and I think your notes or your acknowledgments that you mentioned in passing that your agent sort of rolled his eyes when you said, "I want a third bite at the apple on Jerome Robbins." What is it about him that draws you to him? You did a fantastic PBS documentary. You did the best biography about him called Somewhere. Robbins, Robbins, Robbins. What is that about for you?
He's so American. and, you know, he speaks to me in weird personal ways. I used to have dreams when I was writing the biography that the phone would ring and I would pick up the telephone and this voice at the other end would say, "Amanda, it's Jerry Robbins." And then I would wake up. So it's like he's haunting me. I don't know.
Well, in real life, you may not have spoken to him, but thankfully for all of us, I feel he's spoken to you and through you to the rest of us. So thank you for this great book.
Thank you, Larry.
I guess any show he ever did, because of that box around his name, the famous box, he was always the biggest star. He had the most muscle. But he did actually step in and save Funny Girl. And made it a success. And you have a very beautiful thing he writes about Barbra Streisand. So let's close out with that. But no matter what Barbra Streisand sings about Fanny Brice or herself, by implication, the biggest star or the greatest star in any Jerome Robbins production is going to be Jerome Robbins. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Larry.
Listen, I got 36 expressions, sweet as pie to tough as leather. And that's 6 expressions more than all them Barrymores put together. Instead of just kicking me, why don't they give me a lift? It must be a plot, 'cause they're scared that I got such a gift. Well, I'm miffed, 'cause I'm the greatest star. I am by far, but no one knows it. Wait, they're gonna hear a voice, a silver flute. Ooh, 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 ooh. They'll cheer each toot. Yay, she's terrific when I expose it. Now can't you see to look at me that I'm a natural Camille? As Camille I just feel I've so much to offer. Kid, I know I'd be divine because I'm a natural coffer. Some ain't got it, not a lump. I'm a great big clump of talent. Laugh! Woo-hoo-hoo. They'll bend in half. Did you ever hear the story about the traveling salesman? 1,000 jokes. Stick around for the jokes. 1,000 faces. I reiterate, when you're gifted, then you're gifted. These are facts. I got no axe to grind. Hey, what are they blind? In all of the world so far, I'm the greatest star. Who is the pip with pizzazz? Who is all ginger and jazz? Who is as glamorous as? Who's an American beauty?
Well, where is the time all gone to? This is Larry Maslon here at Broadway to Main Street. Let's catch up next Sunday at 3:00.